Hello, this is Ron Horshefsky, the Executive Director of Orthopedic Surgery Incorporated. Welcome to this OSI podcast about arthroscopic surgery of the shoulder. Today I'm joined by Dr. Christian Anderson, a board-certified orthopedic surgeon from OSI. Dr. Anderson, welcome to today's program.
Thanks, Ron.
I was just wondering if you could explain to me a little bit about what arthroscopic surgery actually is.
Arthroscopy actually is a surgical procedure that's performed with a tiny fiber optic telescope that is about the size of a big pen. And it is typically used in multiple joints, not just the shoulder, but also can be used in the elbow, the wrist, the hip, the knee, and the ankle, just to mention a few.
What kind of diagnoses might need this type of a procedure?
Well, certainly a lot of the more common sports injuries, including rotator cuff tears, labral injuries, in other words, injuries to the cartilage of the shoulder, instability issues, impingement, where bone spurs can impinge against the rotator cuff, injuries to the ligaments that hold the collarbone down, arthritis at the end of the collarbone. That's specifically for the shoulder, obviously. There are also indications in the knee. For example, torn cartilage in the knee is the most common orthopedic surgery performed in the country, in addition to ACL reconstructions, issues with the kneecaps, and so on. We can also use it in the ankle for loose bodies, for stability problems in the ankle. And we've even scoped the big toe for people that have what's called turf toe, to take off bone spurs in the big toe.
Well, so how do you as a surgeon know when a patient does need arthroscopic surgery?
Well, in most cases, they have had a trial of conservative management either under the auspices of our treatment in orthopedics or through their primary care physician with physical therapy. And so by the time that we arrive at a decision for surgical redress, they have essentially attempted and failed a non-surgical management program. And it's usually a discussion between ourselves, and it depends to a great extent, obviously, on how much of an impact they have functionally that then leads to the decision to have the surgery done. It's always a trade-off. It's that cost-benefit trade-off. Mm-hmm. And so once we have arrived at that decision, then we can move on to discuss the technical aspects of their particular requirement for that surgery.
All right, so if I'm one of your patients and you've recommended surgery for me and I have a date schedule and everything, is there anything that I should do as a patient to prepare for that surgery?
Well, typically the first step is to make sure that we've had a conversation about what to expect with the surgery. In other words, the logistics of getting to the hospital. The surgery is not done here in the office. It is done under anesthesia. And that if there's any medical comorbidities, for example, if you have diabetes or issues with your heart or blood pressure, that we do prefer to have your primary care physician give us a pre-surgical evaluation for your medical fitness for surgery so that anesthesia can then balance things as safely as possible for you.
Okay, what kind of anesthesia do you use for this procedure?
Excellent question. It does require anesthesia. It's an invasive technique, even though the incision sites are about the size of a buttonhole on your shirt. And so the surgery is done in the hospital, and the anesthesiologist typically will do a combined technique. They will do a nerve block, which numbs up the nerves that go down your arm and shoulder just above your collarbone before the surgery starts. And then they also have you go to sleep. And the reason we do both is because typically this can take an hour or longer to do the surgery. You have to sit perfectly still. And I am using power tools right next to your ear to get your surgical redress accomplished. And so that combination works out exceedingly well. The local anesthetic with the nerve block gives us wonderful pain relief so that it minimizes the amount of general anesthesia you need. And it also lasts up to 24 hours, and it carries you through that first day pretty nicely.
So do I get to go home that night?
The vast majority are done as an outpatient.
Okay. All right, very good. So do I get, as a patient, do I get the opportunity to speak with you before or after the procedure?
Of course.
Okay.
We've definitely had long conversations before the surgery, leading up to that surgery. And especially afterward, unfortunately, most people don't have a lot of memory of the conversations we have in recovery, so it's always helpful to have a friend or family that is there to accompany them so that I can echo what I've told the patients in the recovery room so that that also is reiterated by their friend or family. And then we usually see them within a few days post-op anyway here in the office.
Okay, I can imagine the average patient walks into the operating room with a little bit of a degree of pain in their shoulder. What kind of pain should a patient expect after this procedure?
Well, the good news is that with the nerve block anesthesia, they have essentially no pain at all for the first 24 hours. The downside, however, is that they will hate me for a couple of days after that, and we go to great lengths to minimize that by using a ice cuff device for cold therapy immediately following the surgery. We actually have two different devices that we apply. The first is done in the hospital. It is a little cooler with a pump attached, and it circulates essentially ice water through the cuff constantly in order to give that cold therapy, which is wonderful for pain relief as well as for swelling. The second device is one that we issue here in the office, and it's a bit more portable. It's a little difficult to get up and walk around with the extension cord attached to your electric pump. So we use a device called an ACT device here in the office, and that is much more mobile. So that can be applied with gel pads that are replaceable. So you freeze one and wear one. In addition, this is what we make drugs for, is for post-op pain relief. And typically we'll have you use the narcotic pain pills in addition to something over-the-counter such as ibuprofen or Aleve. And I also like to throw in Benadryl, which interestingly, despite being for allergy, is a synergist. In other words, it increases the effectiveness of the pain pills, whether that's Tylenol or whether that's Percocet. And so that can be a very useful adjunct for folks that are sensitive to narcotics.
That's very interesting. I imagine that a patient would be in a sling after the procedure as well.
I'm going to say typically. Again, it depends on what they're having done. And so I like to point out your results may vary. But in general, for most of the repair techniques that we do arthroscopically, the patient's placed in a sling at the time of the surgery. They are encouraged to remove that so that they can do pendulum exercises down by their side, and that for comfort then can place their arm back in the sling. Typically we will review all of their do's and don'ts on their specific case right after the surgery with their loved ones, and then also the following visit a few days later in the office.
Okay, are there any risks associated with the procedure?
Another excellent question. You know, every surgery carries a small amount of surgical risk. And arthroscopic surgery, the shoulder is no different. The good news is that unlike open surgery, which carries a risk of infection of around 2 to 3%, the risk of infection in arthroscopy is measured in the hundreds or even thousands, that it's not unusual to have reports of an infection rate of less than 1 in 5,000. So even though it is still a potential risk, the risk is so small that we don't even have the patients take antibiotics post-op. We do a dose of antibiotic just before the surgery starts, and that is sufficient. The second risk that most people don't really think about is the risk of a phlebitis or a blood clot. And again, although that's relatively remote, that's about 1 in 100. And so if they have a family history, or if they have a smoking history, or women that use oral contraceptives, for example, may have a higher individual risk, then sometimes we'll even recommend that we put them on a small blood thinner for a period of time.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about activity levels after surgery. I know you mentioned sometimes people will take off their sling and do some pendulum exercises. Like, what's the expectation in terms of getting back to activities of daily living, just going to work and driving and returning to the golf game that you pursue or whatever it might be?
Sure. That's a long length and breadth of activity, and certainly for someone that's had, for example, a rotator cuff repair, which can oftentimes be the most difficult in terms of recovery, the length of time for them to be completely well, pain-free, and back to full activities can be as long as a year. Whereas if you have had a release for a stiff shoulder, for a capsulitis or a frozen shoulder, you can be out of your sling on the first day and potentially technically playing football the second day, although I'm going to go out on a limb and say I probably wouldn't expect that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think, again, on average, most people find that they are able to drive once they've stopped taking the pain medicine and once they have control of their arm, and that can vary anywhere from just a few days to all the way up to 6 weeks. Again, results may vary depending on the type of repair. As far as being able to sit up and use a keyboard, for example, as soon as they're comfortable. because even with a rotator cuff repair, they can still have their arm by their side, take the sling off, and use a keyboard and a mouse.
So what's the expectation of a patient to come to see you after the surgery in the office?
We virtually always see folks within that first week or so post-op. I do take pictures through the scope. I find that exceedingly helpful in terms of discussing the findings and also the repair techniques. And I like to make a copy for the patients as well, so that I have a set for us and they have a set for their Facebook page.
Well, that's interesting. So you get to actually show them a picture and show them what you did in the results of the surgery, and they get to walk out of the clinic with that picture?
That's right.
Oh, that's fantastic. What about physical therapy? Do all your patients have to go to physical therapy after surgery?
It's not an absolute requirement, but again, I would say the majority end up meeting with the physical therapy folks for anywhere from a few visits to a couple of months, again, depending on the nature of the repair. The folks that have been to therapy previously and already know their way around oftentimes require less. So one of the benefits of having a few visits preoperatively is that they already are familiar with the exercises they'll be doing post-op.
Okay, now if I have an unusual amount of pain after this procedure or something like that, are there certain circumstances that I should call the office after I've had this surgery?
Well, there's a few. First of all, we always have someone available, whether it's myself or one of my partners that's covering call, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we would prefer to hear from you to make sure that it's something relatively minor, because although I've done almost 9,000 arthroscopies, you potentially have had just one, and yours, of course, is the most important to you. So the real warning signs for us, fever that is 100.5 or greater more than a day or so, pain that is not managed well with the ice cuff and the pain medications that we prescribed. And certainly the first couple of days, those can be the most rugged. And so I do expect, fully expect, that people will use most, if not all, of the pain prescription that is provided at the time of the surgery. What I don't want is people to not take it because they're afraid that they're going to become dependent. And really, people that use pain medication properly have less pain. They take less pain medication over the length of time when they medicate themselves properly. We want to be sure that you stay ahead of the pain curve. So the big ones are, again, fever, redness or foul smell coming from the portals. Interestingly, even though it is a shoulder arthroscopy, calf pain or swelling can be a sign of a clot. And so again, even though that's rare, that's about 1 in 100, we would definitely want to hear about that so that we can set up diagnostic studies for that.
That's very interesting. So are there any resources available on the OSI website that would help me learn more about my condition before I went into a surgery?
We've put together several information sheets, both on the diagnostic portion of rotator cuff tears and so on, as well as our post-op instructions. And those are all available on our website.
Okay, very good. So in order to find those, we ask people to go to the patient information tab on our website, and you'll find those resources. Dr. Anderson, is there anything else that you'd like to add? Anything else that you think patients should know before they come in for a shoulder arthroscopic procedure?
Well, I think the first part is that when someone has had a shoulder injury and they've had pain for longer than 3 months, that automatically tells us that this is something that's not going to get better on its own. And so very, very often those individuals will have undertaken a trial of non-operative management, physical therapy, anti-inflammatories, and so on. And even though that may have been undertaken at another facility, we still ask that you come in with an open mind. You know, let me take a look at you. If we need imaging studies, that we get those. And I also like to point out that MRI, despite being the layperson's gold standard, is not always a perfect diagnostic tool. And that really the diagnosis and management of a lot of these shoulder issues is based on a compendium of data points, and the MRI is only one of those. So I like to point out to my folks, don't depend on MRI alone, that it also requires the history, a careful history, a good physical exam, your response to your conservative management program, and whether or not you've had imaging studies that support or don't support that diagnosis.
Well, that's fantastic. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for sharing this information with us, and we look forward to doing future podcasts together again.
My pleasure.